This conference will now be recorded.
It is Monday, May 12, 2014. This is the final Aeneid discussion for the Reading Odyssey this year. We've read Sarah Rudin's wonderful translation, and we're thrilled to say we have Sarah Rudin on the phone with us this evening. So we expect to have a wonderful conversation with our wonderful translator. Very excited. Just a few things. We have on Wednesday night the Herodotus Salon with Professors Paul Cartledge and Jamie Rahm. That's at 7 p.m. New York time. For those of you on the phone, just a reminder, I think many of you are going to be with us. And tonight we'll do a format. I'm going to introduce Sarah. Then I will ask, well, first I'll let everyone respond to just having Sarah with us. I know there's a lot of excitement. And then we'll see where we go. I do want to ask about favorite passages in our final three books of the Aeneid. And of course, we have a number of questions for Sarah herself. So let's get started. Just before I made the recording on, it sounded like someone wanted to say something. I might have cut them off. Okay.
Okay. Could you turn it up a little?
Sure. Who's that speaking?
This is Sarah.
Okay, Sarah. Okay, let me hold the microphone to my mouth. Is that better?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, good. All right, so Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
We're so thrilled to have you. Just a quick introduction. Sarah and I met 5, 6, 7 years ago through Bob Strassler at one of the earlier Reading Odyssey events. And she, some of you have met her. She was with us at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and at least one or two dinners. She is, today she's at the, I think a visiting scholar at Yale Divinity School, or a scholar in residence, Sarah, is that right?
No, I'm at Brown now.
You're at Brown now. Okay.
I'm visiting at Brown, yes.
Yeah. And she's a poet, translator, of course, an essayist. She's written a wonderful book that I'm looking forward to reading, several of her books and poetry, including a book called Paul Among the People, the Apostle Reinterpreted and Reimagined in His Own Time, which has kicked up a lot of interest and controversy because she's kind of taken a position that's a little different than the received convention, anyway, on who Paul was. So she's done a lot, and most important for all of us on the phone tonight, she's made this great gift of a translation of the Aeneid, which I agree with the New York Review of Books. It is it stands as an English poem in itself, and soars above the high bar that Robert Fagles himself set. So I want to start with, first of all, I know some of you just want to join me in welcoming Sarah. Elizabeth, I know you had a comment.
No, I just thought the translation was great. I just enjoyed the book very much. I just wanted to thank her.
Yeah.
Well, you're very welcome. This is so, this is so encouraging to me. Translating ancient languages is hard, and lonely. It's grinding work, and I don't know what I would do without the encouragement of hearing from people like you that they have really enjoyed it, that they have found it meaningful.
Well, we have a lot of encouragement for you then, because we have loved it. Kendall, do you want to say what you were beginning to say earlier?
Yeah, and Sarah, I'm in awe of your genius and your artistry and your intellect. I can't even begin to imagine how you tackle something like this. And I was just struck throughout that I feel that only a poet could have done this translation, and sort of the balance of all of you that's in here and how brilliantly you stayed out of the way of you know, get not getting in the way of Virgil's voice, you know, and just making that accessible to us. I'm just in awe of you, and I thank you so much for your brilliant work.
Oh, well, you are so welcome. You're so kind. You are more than kind. Thank you.
Well, let me share one piece of that brilliance. And, Sarah, as we've been reading this, we have often commented on the language itself in your translation, that you seem to be a master poet. And you introduce a number of off rhymes or slant rhymes that just make the translation so gorgeous and accessible at the same time. So if we read, so Robert Fagel's, you know, the first few lines of his translation, and he's got a very good translation. This is not a criticism at all. Wars and a man I sing, an exile driven on by fate. He was the first to flee the coast of Troy, destined to reach Lavinian shores and Italian soil. Yet many blows he took on land and sea from the gods above. Thanks to cruel Juno's relentless rage and many losses he bore in battle too, before he could found the city, bring his gods to Latium, source of the Latin race, the Alban lords and the high walls of Rome. A really good, very good translation, obviously. Your translation, though, arms and a man I sing, the first from Troy, a fated exile to Lavinian shores in Italy, on land and sea, divine will and Juno's unforgetting rage harassed him, war racked him, too, until he set his city and gods in Latium. There his Latin race rose with Alban patriarchs and Rome's high walls. And so, you know, when I read this, it's, you know, I mean, so many things jump out, harassed and racked. I mean, fantastic. Of course, Italy, sea, and city, upsets and hardships. My first question to you, as you did this translation, I mean, talk to us about the poetry and how is it that you achieved in the same number of lines as Virgil, which is another unbelievable feat of yours, a translation that is so rich in the English language and so rich in the choice of words and words that both seem to capture the image so successfully, but give us also this kind of slant and off rhyme as well as, you know, straight rhymes.
Oh, well, you know what I think it's about? You know, at the beginning, it's that I was raised on the King James Bible. And we hadn't, in Ohio, you know, Methodists, in our small town, we had not made the transition, you know, to newer Bibles. So it was about the King James, and it was about hymns, you know, derived from that, you know, resting on that language. And, the King James kind of, works this way in English. And, you know, those sounds, you know, if you, you know, hear these texts regularly, the sounds will kind of work their way in. And, you know, I think otherwise I just paid a lot of attention to the Latin and was careful to reproduce a Latin word order where I could. You know, it's my yeah. feeling that, you know, Virgil was a very great genius and did everything for a reason. So there's, you know, no word there that he didn't put in the right place. And he, you know, he wrote about two lines a day over so many years. So it's just, it's not me. It's mainly about listening.
Pat, do you want to follow up that?
Yeah, I was going to ask, Sarah, is there You say you reproduced the Latin word order, and I'm just curious, is there sort of a characteristic to that that distinguishes it from English? Because there's a flowing quality to it that's, you know, different from pacing and the word order of, you know, both English prose and a lot of poetry.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Could you repeat it?
So you were saying you reproduce Virgil's word order. So I'm assuming that in Latin there are certain rules or characteristic ways of sequencing words in a sentence that are different from English. Each language has its own properties this way, right? Their own syntax and their own.
Yeah. Well. You know, Latin word order is extremely flexible because the language is inflected. So there's a great deal of meaning contained in single words because you can change them. You just reshape the word and it's got an of in it, you know, an of meaning or a with meaning or by means of or, you know, and
because of suffixes and prefixes and all that.
Exactly. Yeah, the verbs are especially flexible. You know, you don't even need subject pronouns. So you can move these words around the line, you know, pretty much any way you want. There's very little, you know, that doesn't fit somehow into this hexameter line, even though it's a demanding one. Interestingly, the word imperator doesn't fit into the hexameter anywhere. That is the word for general. So Virgil was forced to write this great war poem without using the proper word, the military word for general. He worked this language, and so the words are sort of anywhere in the line, but always somewhere with very nice effect. For example, the first line is arma virumque cano, arms and a man, except the and comes after man. So he's got arms and man right beside each other. And you can do this is wonderful in Latin. You can put the and either between words or after second word that's being joined. You could do a que, the et is the one that goes between and the que goes afterwards. There are two ways to do this. So man and arms, right side by side. Proiae qui primus ab oris. Of Troy, the first man, from the shores. And so I thought that was interesting, and I tried to see the second line. I've got the shores at the end, and it's not. You kind of always have to do something different. You can never do what the Latin is doing quite. But I put the Troy at the end of the first line there, because we're talking about the place from which, and there's some weight on that at the end of the first line. So I had to do something in English to reflect that. But you know, it's just a continual despair and frustration because you will never do what you can hear Virgil doing, and he makes it look easy. It was, of course, you know, according to his biography, it was very hard. He did it slowly, but you know, his genius just makes it look so easy.
So when you were translating, I mean, I loved what you said about listening, Sarah, how closely you listened to Virgil, as well as, of course, being influenced by the language of the King James Bible. I've been listening to a lot of poetry lately, and it's remarkable. I've been listening to a lot of Walt Whitman, and, you know, the remarkable thing that I've discovered is that a lot of his phraseology is a part of and has shaped everyday language in America. So people are literally reciting Walt Whitman and they don't even realize it. I will hear phrases. Now, in some cases, maybe you pick those up from what people were already saying, but I hear it. But this listening that you talked about, I just want to ask one more question, and then we can move into some more of the content, which I know people are also eager to speak about. But, I mean, what is, so the despair that you, what is it like to listen to Virgil and then create, it seems to me you must be listening both to Virgil and very closely to English at the same time, right? I mean, this is, I guess, partly the translator's art, but also the art of the translator who is also a poet. Because it's not enough to select a word that has literal meaning. You're also, you're looking at rhythm and sound, as well as texture, I would say, right? So what was your, like, how long did it take you to write the first few sentences, or not sentences, verses here?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I started with book four. And I don't really remember how long that took. Just a draft. I mean, an early draft. It was worked over a lot later. But it's a process, you know, that started back in my teens. And I was, there was no Latin in my public high school in Bowling Green, Ohio. They had a Latin teacher, but they had sent her to teach typing. years before, in the 60s, they had decided no, Latin was worthless, and she must teach typing. because that could give students something of lasting value. I mean, imagine making that decision.
Typing is important. I grant that.
Yeah, but you know. I was horrible at typing, and I thought that this was going to be a big drag on my career. But then word processing came along, and I guess nobody really studies typing anymore. anyway, I had to go to the university to you know find people who would teach me Latin, and they were just wonderful, and they you know worked very hard with me, and. Reading Latin poetry is a special discipline in itself, because this is it's a qualitative, not a quantitative meter. It's not bum bada bum bada, you know, stress syllables.
Yeah.
It's about the length of syllables. So,
yeah.
And the pattern, the metrical pattern, is not the same in every line. It varies quite a bit. So you have to know the length of the syllables, which is tricky in places. I remember bringing a metronome into the professor's office one day and setting it off because just reading to it because I just couldn't get this rhythm right. You know, I was just spending too much time or not enough, you know, different syllables. So I had to, you know, really slowly learn how to do this. And it sounds kind of like Armawerum Quacano Troy Aqui Prim Usab Oris. It's all dragged out. I don't even think I can do it well. But it's something you have to learn. So, and you're scrutinizing each syllable or else you can't do it. So that's really...
it's often true that when you're learning Latin, I learned Latin a long time ago, and by the way, I don't remember almost any of it, but that you do study Virgil is, you know, one of the things that students are given and asked to start to translate it. So are you saying that the translation work you started as a teenager actually ended up becoming some of the language that you used here, that literally you've been working on it in a way since then?
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, I as an undergraduate, I translated another work of Virgil, the Eclogues. Those are his pastoral poems. So, you know, in my late teens, I was already, you know, playing with English versions of it. And it's the same kind of meter. and kind of hard to get your head around. So if people like my translation, it's because I've worked on this stuff for 30 years or more.
Is that about a word a day then? Is that
I mean not at that pace really. I've done other things, but
I mean Virgil did a line a day, but it is really more a word or perhaps a syllable.
Syllable a day, yeah.
Well, I mean it reads like it's 30 years of very hard work. I mean it's a true gift. Sarah, that's lovely.
Bill, let me ask a follow-up question, Sarah. Historically, would Virgil have, would this type of work be performed by an orator? Would Virgil actually speak this? How was it transmitted to his audience, I guess is what I'm trying to understand.
Okay, you know how it was performed. That's what you're asking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we know we have a pretty reliable account of Virgil himself performing it at the court of Augustus, and
do we have a recording of that, Sarah? Or?
Sorry.
I asked if we had a recording of that.
We do not have a recording of it. No, it's not on YouTube. Anyway, Virgil is, he is, you know, at some point in his composition, his patron, you know, Augustus wanted to hear some of this, and Virgil was reading to Augustus and his family, and that included, you know, the mother who had lost a son, and this is this part in book six, you know, this famous elegy to this very promising young man who died, and leaving Augustus really without an heir. Mm-hmm. And in what was to become this dynasty, and it was a terrible tragedy. And so apparently, you know, this elegy was greeted with great grief, you know, with sobbing, fainting. It made a great impression. We could just sort of assume that Virgil read it out, you know, in the proper cadences. This is a very old traditional form of poetry, the hexameter. And then it became very quickly a school text. So when you learn Latin, you read this. And several centuries later, St. Augustine, he's a kid. He's not Augustine yet. He falls in love with Virgil, and he's reading it like like the Lord of the Rings. You know, this is romance, this is excitement, this is fantasy for him, and it's a major temptation away from the Christian life, strongly recommended by his mother. To him it was just the pinnacle of classical culture. You know, the highest point of civilization for him. This, you know, extremely entertaining, moving, meaningful poem. And he probably like a lot of kids, used this at Cicero to learn literary Latin, which is a special kind of language. You know, not the colloquial stuff. This is the Latin that you would read and vibe to make yourself into a formal orator so you could pursue your political career, which he proceeded to do. So it was really almost from the very beginning, it was a centerpiece of classical culture. This was the thing that, you know, every kid should be able to recite, every educated kid. This is a thing you perform at dinner parties. You know, you stand up, chant it, sing it, you discuss it. Juvenal has this funny piece about how crazy women are about the Aeneid, and especially Dido, and they think Dido has had a bad deal, so they make themselves really irritating at the dinner party by describing what a dick Aeneas is, you know.
We had a version of that conversation actually here a couple months
ago. Yeah, it's kind of a perpetual conversation.
Yeah.
Because it's so,
yeah.
I mean, that book, the so-called Tragedy of Dido, it's just eternal. It's just got so much in it.
But
yeah.
These last few books that we've been reading are so bloody and violent, it's really hard to imagine them being recited, you know, for pleasure, because they're horrifying. At least to me.
They are kind of horrifying. You know, and I've been asked, when I lecture on Virgil, I get asked about this so-called aesthetic of violence, which is very concerning, especially concerning to me. I'm a Quaker. we are pledged to nonviolence. I kind of concentrate on this incredible beauty, sublimity of the language,
sure,
as compared to the, you know, the whole, the everyday kind of horrifying human nature as expressed in, especially in violence.
Well, yeah,
and
I'm not. Sorry.
Oh, well, what I kind of invoke, like to invoke is the nature documentary,
mm-hmm,
which is about, the classic one is about the lion pride,
yeah,
and, you know, how they're fighting among each other, they're bringing down wildebeest, and, you know, munching on raw wildebeest, but it is beautifully filmed. You know, you have these slow motion sequences, you've got very nice narration, and then you have an alternation with scenes in which the cubs are playing and they're nursing, and you know, the lion pride is at peace, and it's a sense, I think there's an aesthetic sense of you know, life being just amazingly, unaccountably, all of these things at once.
Elizabeth,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, I'm not actually criticizing Virgil. I
sure.
just can't imagine it being recited at a dinner party. I mean, I think that what you, you know, the nature documentary is a perfect sort of analog, because you know, he's often comparing the warriors to beasts and birds of prey, and it's, you know, it's, I mean,
yeah,
it's very vivid. I just think it's not, it's just hard for me to imagine it sort of being recited to children and at parties and all of that.
Yeah, well, we're talking, to a degree, we're talking about a different sensibility altogether.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Homer was recited at dinner parties so much,
mm-hmm,
that there were professional Homer reciters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, there were people you could hire or own, you know, if you were wealthy enough,
mm-hmm,
who had memorized Homer and would recite that at the dinner party. And, you know, also, you know, we could talk about just a very different taste in entertainment in the ancient world, because they would also have dwarves. They would have, you know, various clowns, lower class people. you know, whose humiliation was part of the entertainment at dinner. That happened too. So we can talk about just a low level of fellow feeling. Mm-hmm. And this I would, you know, personally think has to do with, you know, pre-Christian society.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine, Sarah, that at the dinner party, depending on who was there, or, you know, obviously they're not going to recite the whole poem, it would be too long, and they're going to look at it, they're going to use excerpts, and it may be more, you know, it might be different parts of the poem would be focused on at different points or different evenings or different kinds of, you know, effects with children or whatever.
That could well have been, yes.
Yeah. Well, let me ask a question of the readers, that sort of builds on what Elizabeth is saying. And tonight, of course, we have Sarah as our special guest, so we won't have as much of a conversation about the last three books of the Aeneid. But perhaps we could at least discuss the very final, you know, page, and really that final scene with Aeneas and Turnus. And, you know, what did you think about the end of the poem where Aeneas makes a decision to just clearly kill him right there? And what did you think about that? What did that mean to you? How did you see that? Was that surprising or expected? And how did that flow with all the earlier stuff about Aeneas and the morality that we've talked about in earlier calls?
Yeah, I mean, you can go at this from several angles, and there's been a lot of you know, ink spilled over this, particularly in the 20th century, when you've got arguments going on about Virgil as a propagandist, and you know, you can say that this you know, clear degradation of Aeneas into a, you know, vengeful man, hateful man, you know, undercuts his patriotism in the rest of the poem, you know, his sense of the Roman fate being the good fate for the entire world. Because, you know, here's its representative just cutting loose and killing a pleading, surrendered enemy. So you could say that. I have a
question about the abruptness of the ending. I mean, mm-hmm. I literally turned the page to read the epilogue, and there wasn't one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole question of whether this is actually an unfinished piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And should we take that into consideration?
Yes, it is unfinished. We have, you know, a reliable account of that. Virgil meant this poem to be twice as long, mm-hmm. and he died unexpectedly on a journey. And he wanted all of his manuscript burned. Mm-hmm. So we only have it because people didn't do what he said. you know, that's the biographical angle that you know, you can consider too. Was this an accident? Was it, you know, entirely an accident? Did he plan to rebuild his hero and you know, turn him into a paragon of civilization? And that you know, could well have happened had you had six more books here, or 12. No, I think it was going to be another 12.
And sorry to interrupt. Do we know what his plan was? I mean, would it have been like, would there have been more books in the middle of the story that we already have, or would they all have been added to the end? And what would the rest of the story have been like?
It was all going to go on the end, because we have a continuous story, So it was going to be about, you know, Aeneas' victory, his settlement of Rome, and he does die. There's another war in which he dies, you know, according to the legend. So I think we would have had that. That it would be this other half would have been mainly the nation-building half. Or that's what, you know, that's sort of what's come down to us. But, you know, it's second or third hand, so we really don't know. But anyway, there is, I think, pretty good reason to believe that he would have rebuilt his hero had he lived, had he had a chance, because he died fairly young.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this sort of, you know, for me, the ending marvelously works because we don't know, and we don't know what to think. And this is, I think, he certainly rises above propaganda here in that, you know, he doesn't, you know, hand us an explanation. And he is not there obtrusively as an author, as, you know, somebody with, you know, who's getting money from Augustus to write this poem, you know, or right. as a Roman, as a, you know, particular, a Roman of a particular class, or, you know, he just sort of leaves us with us, and he leaves this with us, and there's just this great mystery of what does all this mean, and it's dumped in our lap, and we need to figure it out, and I think that's what the greatest literature does. It just leaves you with this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have a question. Was it a hit right away, or did it take a couple hundred years before it was accepted as part of the canon? Were people reading it right after?
It was an instant hit.
Okay.
Yeah. That's as far as we can tell. Yeah. Augustus loved it. He had a whole circle of poets around him, and a couple of people who were sort of running them, Maecenas and Messala, who were managing all of this literary production, and everybody, that whole circle, thought that this was an amazing poem. So it got out very fast, and Augustus, you know, was certainly using this literature to bolster his image as a civilization builder, as a nation builder. So from what we hear, and, you know, just from what we could expect, there was no time at all lost in getting this stuff out, and everybody picked it up very quickly, so it gets into the school curriculum really quickly. Horace, who was a colleague of Virgil, says about his own work, he's addressing it. He says, "Look, I know you're gonna be in the primary school curriculum. I know that's what's gonna happen to you." So Horace, you're still alive, you know, and he's still mm-hmm. producing this stuff,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. it's very clear what it was fated to be.
Mm.
So it came out, you know, as he was writing it. I mean, how did he make it public?
Okay.
Didn't wait
well,
until he finished. I mean, obviously, he didn't finish it. So.
Virgil, we don't exactly know. Virgil seems to have managed to keep it to himself as he was working on it.
Mm-hmm.
He did recite it, we know that, to Augustus. So Augustus was probably being fed pieces of it,
mm-hmm.
But Virgil's attitude very clearly was, this isn't finished.
Mm-hmm.
So Augustus seems to have respected that, and it didn't circulate among the general public, it looks like, until after Virgil's death. You know, and then, of course, the manuscript is seized and it's published as it is. And you can see that there are half lines scattered throughout the poem. And this is maybe even, you know, I'm an author myself, so I kind of can speculate, you know, these were maybe the insurance that Virgil had, at least during his lifetime, that the stuff would not go out until he thought it was finished, because he could point and he could say, look, these lines aren't done.
Mm-hmm.
You can't circulate this. Mm-hmm. You can't have it, you know, until I'm finished with it, because look, it's not even put together.
Mm-hmm. Those were his locks.
Yeah, you could think of that. You could think of it that way. Yeah.
Where was this?
You know, if I had a very powerful patron, I might do that.
Hey, I just want. Hey, hang on a second. I know. I think that may be Alan. I just wanted to see if we could hear from a couple of the other readers. Nancy, did you want to chime in? Are you still with us? It's always a danger when I call like that. All right, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, sir, do you think this work was done as a commission? And if so, who commissioned?
Well, it depends on what you mean by commission.
Did somebody pay to have a work? Was Virgil paid to generate this work?
Absolutely, yeah. Or not, but you know, there are different ways that we can imagine this. And we really don't know about it in any detail, but we do know in a fair amount of detail, we know about Horace's career. Now, Horace was a very, very talented poet, but he was the son of a freedman. So he was just one generation away from slavery. And his father managed to get him educated, and then he was noticed by Augustus and taken on and promoted. And he has a lot of autobiographical poetry, so we know in amazing detail, you know, what, from him anyway, what the Augustan literary circle was like. And according to Horace, okay, but Horace was poor, okay, and he didn't have, unless he wanted to work as a clerk, you know, he didn't have any other source of income. Virgil was, in fact, pretty well-to-do, probably financially independent, but his family farm was confiscated after the Civil Wars, and Augustus saw that he got it back. So that's one thing we know about the relationship, the financial, practical relationship between Augustus and Virgil. But Horace says all kinds of stuff, you know, or says stuff from which we can infer a lot more. But it's clear Augustus bought him property, gave him a stipend, gave him some assignments, which were for political purposes, you know, were performed in public,
mm-hmm.
Like a long poem to be recited, you know, at a particular festival. But otherwise let him do what he wanted, and even allowed him to go off to the country to the estate that Augustus had bought him, and sit around there and have writer's block month after month. And Augustus would beg for poetry, and Horace would, in a poem, he would say no, and he would publish that poem. and so it was, I mean, it's a bit, it, it, this whole thing could be kind of tricky if you think about it. I mean, maybe it was all kind of a game, and Horace is demonstrating to the public, look, you know, I am not this person's lackey. I am an independent artist. You know, I do what I want. But, you know, what we can see is this very close personal and business relationship between the second great poet that Augustus patronized.
Yeah.
So there's no, I think there's not the slightest doubt, Virgil was financially dependent, and at least a lot of what he wrote was what Augustus wanted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, Scott, do you want to comment or share some thoughts with Sarah or ask a question on the parallels between the Aeneid and Homer's Iliad and Odyssey?
Well, actually, I'd love to, but before I do that, I had just gone to your webpage, which I didn't even know about, and I saw that you did the Homeric hymns before. Or do you would you ever plan on tackling the Iliad or the Odyssey?
Well, there've been some discussions, but the trouble is that you know, that's a project that's just about exactly four times as long.
Right.
You have
120 years.
it would take an awfully long time, and you know, the practical difficulty is funding it up front.
So you need a patron,
like Virgil.
I need a patron. Yeah. patron nowadays is a publishing company, and they have to give you an advance that's large enough for you to complete the work. So.
So if we actually had
this discussion. There was an editor and I who had the discussion about how much money it would take, and he said, name a sum, and I said, it is a sum that dare not speak its name. So that was the end of the discussion, but it's you know, you got to think about maybe 5 or 7 years' work and a mortgage to be paid in the meantime, so and groceries to be bought. So it's just it hasn't been doable. You see, I don't have a regular faculty post.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
You know, a professor like Fagles can undertake something like this because he has income from elsewhere. I do this for a living, so I'm more restricted.
So we just need to come up with 7 years of salary or something for you.
Oh. You can pass the hat right there.
And Sarah, do you do...
Yeah, go ahead.
Sarah, do you do other writing as well?
Yeah.
Creative writing?
Well, I have. You can have a look at my website.
Right now.
And I have, I've got the book on Paul, and I'm completing another book, which is called The Music Inside the Whale and Other Marvels,
mm-hmm.
A Translator on the Beauty of the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So I talk about, you know, what Koine Greek is like and what classical Hebrew is like and how untranslatable the Bible is. And I'm having a blast, really, with this book.
Wonderful.
And you've got it. Other Places, which is a book of your own poetry, right?
Yeah, there's that. I do publish poetry still in periodicals. So you can find that in Commonweal sometimes or National Review. I publish that. I publish a lot of essays and reviews, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is Nancy. Sorry, I heard the question earlier and I but here I am. But so I really would like to know sort of more generally what the Aeneid sort of how it speaks to you and sort of what it means to you and what you got out of reading it, why it's important to you.
Well, I think the Aeneid really, while this is going to sound very weird. The Aeneid in South Africa really helped me not to be so prissy. Because I'm, you know, I'm a Quaker, and I spent a long time at Harvard. So, you know, pacifists can be fairly, I would say, you know, prissy. they can have this feeling that they are better than other people. And I don't have to tell you about the Harvard attitude that people acquire. You know, but then I go out, you know, for my first job to, well, my only, you know, regular academic job. I went out to University of Cape Town right before the first multiracial election and experienced the new South Africa and sort of got to know my place in the world as an American. And I had felt, you know, very superior as an American, I think, my whole life. And, you know, here, all of a sudden, you know, I am in the middle of this quite violent, contentious society. And apartheid had kept a lid on things, on, you know, horrific inequality and oppression. You know, and that lid was off, you know. So things were going to be fought out, and they're still being fought out there. And, you know, it's amazing what people are really like when their jobs are at stake, when their property's at stake. And, you know, I found out that was not different than other people, really. I mean, my feelings and my reactions, so I didn't, like some other people, you know, grab a gun and use it. And, you know, I had not wanted, and I was still in South Africa when I took on this translating job, and I loved Virgil aesthetically, but I did not want to translate this major war poem. And I did it to stay in the translating field because it was it had the prospect of more readers, certainly, than most other classics works. And so I took it on and I translated it. And, you know, I just got the sense, and this really... it was a sense that grew along with my Christian convictions that, you know, the human being is an astonishing creation, you know, has astonishing potential for good and for evil. And, you know, literature is a way, for me, it's not so much a way to understand this, but it's a way to contemplate this and to feel wonder and to feel humility and to get the sense that, you know, this is too strange. There must be some larger purpose to all of this.
It's a remarkable and wonderfully honest answer, Sarah. Thank you for being so giving and open with us.
Well, you're very welcome. Well, thank you very much for the discussion. You've all really this is a bright spot in the week. You know, I have a kind of manuscript due at the end of the month, and it's sort of a lonely, hardworking time, and so you have cheered me up and encouraged me tremendously, all of you. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments for Sarah or the Aeneid?
Well, vice versa. Thank you, Sarah. It's really just, you know, everything you say is profound, and it's really deepened my appreciation. I'm going to read your other books.
Well, thank you so much. Sorry, was that somebody else?
I just wanted to also thank Phil for bringing us Sarah.
Yes, Phil, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so very much for books.
Thank you so much. Yeah, books have done a lot for me.
And for people who love books.
Sarah, I'm working on a TEDx talk that I'll be giving here in New York in June. In fact, I'll send an invitation to all of you if you'd like to come to the event. But interestingly, the talk is it very much resonates with what you were saying here at the end about humility and the discovery that in your case, you, and in my case, me, are very much like most other people. I won't say more, because I'll be interested to see what you think. I'll send you the video when it's up, but I think it's just so important. And what an experience to go from, you know, you grew up in an academic family, you go to Harvard, and then you go to the University of Cape Town. That's a transition from apartheid to democracy. I mean, that is, you know, a pretty profoundly different kind of culture and political moment than anything you had experienced. Interestingly, Pat, who's on the call, who started reading Odyssey with me close to 10 years ago now, we became best friends in college as anti-apartheid activists and leaders of our anti-apartheid movement where we were. Yeah. Fun little connection there. And I spent time in Africa, but Nigeria, because I couldn't go to South Africa. That was during the time of apartheid and because of my activities. But I did spend time in Nigeria, including in the north of Nigeria, where these kidnappings have been happening. And it so deeply saddens me to see what's been happening in the north of Nigeria. And because I'll tell you that the profound majority of people up there are decent, and were extremely, extraordinarily welcoming of me when I was there so long ago.
That's what you don't learn from the news is how loving and forgiving Africans are. And that is astonishing.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't expect that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's deeply astonishing and profoundly impactful to have that experience. Well, I want to thank everybody for really, I think, working hard. And Scott, you know, I was just so impressed by the terrific work that you did analyzing some of the parallels between the Aeneid and the Iliad and Odyssey. I thought that was a great gift you gave to all of us as readers. So I want to thank you and thank everyone for continuing on this journey, this Odyssey. Wednesday night we're having the Herodotus Salon with Paul Cartledge and Jamie Rahm. That should be really terrific. Always a great chance to spend time with those two. And then I was actually asking Sarah before everyone got on, I think we will read Lucretius in the fall, and I'm currently reviewing, and I actually said this to you before, I'm reviewing translations. There unfortunately is no Sarah Rudin as far as I can tell, but we'll pick one and let you know and send out invitations. We'll also be doing a Herodotus section in the fall. So if any of you have not yet read or have not read Herodotus in a long time and want to, by the way, I can't tell you enough what it's like to read Herodotus a second time. It's just amazing to read Herodotus a second time. You start to see the architecture and the elegance of what an unbelievable creation he gave to the world. So if you want to read it again, we'll be doing that in the fall. And if you haven't read it, join us for that. and we'll be doing some more events and lectures and stuff, so we'll keep you updated.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks.
Great,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Phil.
Okay, good night.
Thanks,
Emma.
Okay.
Good night.
Right.
Thanks.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
The organizer has disconnected, and this conference will continue for 60 minutes.